Okay, we're ready to turn the meeting over to Brother Harry here. As everybody can see well, the subject there, the cries of the reapers.
Okay, good morning, brother. Our title is The Cries of the Reapers. Normally we'd open with hymn 89, The Divine Goodness, so you might want to take a look at that for... it mentions about difficult experiences, but God's wisdom in fulfilling his plan. The cries of the reapers. This is a very interesting topic. It's actually, I think, a very thrilling topic. It has a lot to do with economics. And when I was going through school, through college and whatnot, I was getting a biology degree initially, and for some reason, I took three courses in economics. One at general, economics 101, microeconomics, and then money and banking. And I was looking back and I was saying, why in the world did I take that for a biology major? Well, you never know how the Lord is going to bring things from your experience into use that in your understanding of the truth. So, this has always been a very exciting topic to me. And another thing that we're going to talk about is that, as we know, the fourth volume, which is where this study comes from, The Cries of the Reapers, also we'll see it comes from James. But The Cries of the Reapers is something that Brother Russell put in the fourth volume in 1897. He talked about it in two earlier references, just sort of a Views from the Tower and something just in passing before that. As far as I've been able to find, he never talked about it again. But and so all of a sudden, this lesson in 1897 sort of stops. But as we're going to see, this lesson is exactly right. Not one word had to be changed all the way through 1914 through 1918 and on. And what he was talking about took place exactly. And it's interesting when we look at other things after 1897, the overrulings of the Lord in this, to me, are just absolutely amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Well, if you look at the fourth volume, The Cries of the Reapers, Brother Russell talks about it with respect to Zephaniah 1:18. Neither their gold, neither their silver, nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. And he also mentions that this lesson is for the thoughtful student of history. So we want to be thoughtful students. We actually want to look at the history, put things together, see God's plan. We know what God's plan is. God's plan was he's going to take down the church-state system in 1914. How is this going to be brought about? They're not just going to walk away of their own accord. Tremendous forces are going to be brought to bear to make this happen. And we also know that this is about silver, and it is about gold. In fact, this is an 1878 silver dollar, which we have right here. That's an 1874 gold dollar. And I'm not going to pass them around because that's distracting. But if you'd like to see these later, that'd be fine. So this is all based upon, this whole study is based upon James 5, 1 through 9. Go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped, here's the cries of the reapers, are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton, but behold, now the judge standeth before the door. So, this is a prophecy of the last days. It talks about a fraud, those who were reapers. And this is really literal reapers or farmers. But now the judge is standing before the door. And one thing we know for sure is that this judgment upon Christendom comes in 1914. This is when it begins. This is a prophecy of the last days, beginning in 1874. we can see the plagues beginning soon thereafter, building, resulting in the time of trouble, the Battle of Armageddon, the destruction of Christendom. And when we talk about Christendom, what we want to see is that from A254, how does Brother Russell define Christendom? And this mixed system, church and state, the church nominal, wedded to the kingdoms of this world, which the Lord calls Babylon confusion, presumes to call itself Christendom, Christ's kingdom. So that when we talk about Christendom, this is what we're talking about in the context of this lesson. This is going to cause an upheaval of society because the church-state systems, primarily in Europe, they were entrenched. They were economically entrenched. There had been smaller upheavals in the past. The French Revolution, many, many different wars, kingdoms fighting against kingdoms, but there was always stability. Well, if you're going to overturn Christendom itself, you're going to have to dig down to the very foundation of that society, dig it up, turn it over. It's an upheaval, so you got to get down and upheave whatever the real economic foundation is. And, of course, this study comes from Volume 4, The Cries of the Reapers. Well, to me, this brings to mind this Zephaniah 3:8. Therefore, wait upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. Well, this was done, as we know, through colonization. Most of the nations of the world were associated in some way with Christendom, the nations of Europe. Many were the colonies of Europe. Well, why did they do this? It wasn't through their benevolence as Christian nations. This is abundantly clear in reading the fourth volume, and which is really a history book. It's just documenting these things. But they were being linked economically through trade, through commerce, through transportation. That's how they were all being assembled. Then the closer ties they had, the more they would be part of this earth, this established society, religious society under the ecclesiastical heavens of the church-state system, and they would be devoured. So God would use this economic linkage to shake their stability to the very core to accomplish God's goals. God's goals. Now, as we go through this study, we want to keep in mind some questions. What was the most stable element of society? Well, I sort of let the cat out of the bag already. What happened to them? How did it happen? Were they alone in this? Did the rest of the world share in this? And what we're going to see is the timing is very important to see what is actually happening. Did the politicians and kings know what was happening? And if they did, or if when they found out, could they fix it? Did they have the power to actually straighten things out? Because after all, they were supposed to be ruling by divine right in Europe, you know, God-given wisdom. Or could they fix these problems? Who did it to them? How did the monetary system work? What was the ultimate result of this? How did this affect Christendom? Was there an upside? Was there something that good happened to it? Was there actually justice in this? I think this will be very interesting. And what about today? What about today? Okay. Now, the most stable part of society is agriculture, farmers. And what do you do in agriculture? Well, you create value, actually create value out of land and labor. Your work, the land, these resources, you put them together with your sweat, your blood. You're going to create value, things that other people want in order to pay for, things that will give you food and quality of life and et cetera. And food, you got grain, vegetables, meats, fruit, these are all things we're very familiar with. Also clothing from flax. Flax is grown to, and they make linen with this, wool, cotton. Also, if you want to look at transportation or power. Transportation, I mean, for years and years, if you're going to go somewhere, you're going to have a horse or a donkey or an ox. If you're going to have some power, maybe have a water wheel if you're pretty smart. But if you don't, you're going to get a big beast of burden. This is through agriculture. So farmers are really where the source of value, for the most part, came. The most stable part of society. And this was the foundation of civilization in Christendom. In fact, if we go back, this is very interesting. If you look up the Duke of Berry in France, The Book of Hours, He had commissioned painting all these paintings that show the status of society. And this is just an example. And in all of these paintings, you find the king up here in the castle, you know, living the life of luxury. And what is the foundation of it? Down below, here's agriculture. Here's the farmer who is really supporting these kingdoms. Really, the agriculture is what is doing it. Now, you don't have for every farmer, you've got a king, but for every king, you've got thousands, if not millions, of farmers supporting them. And the fruits of their labor are going up towards the kingdom. That is what the stability is. So because the farmer can create actual value from these products, from the land, from his work, he is traditionally not greatly affected by changes in government. He creates the value himself. This is where the value is coming from. Food, clothing, etc. And he's independent of city strife. Cities are real, you know, where you have a congregation of people. That's where a lot of political problems take place. Government policies change and whatnot. But the farmer always has his land, his labor. Whether he owns the farm or whether, and typically in Europe he didn't own much of anything. He was there working. But he was kept alive and given his necessities because this was the labor content that was necessary to create this value. So he was not rich, but he was stable, and really created the stable element of society itself. But there was a change coming. With the time of the end and the increase of knowledge, this whole situation began to change. With the time of the end in 1799, marked by Napoleon's Egyptian campaign, we find that there are changes are coming. We have wars taking place. Now, there have been wars in the past, but we have wars and the draft. We've got people coming from the farms into the cities, going into the armies, where they have to be educated because technology is beginning to advance. They're learning more things. They have more travel. They're exposed to a lot more information. You have the Industrial Revolution which has actually been taking place already in the late 1700s. The Industrial Revolution is taking place. New ideas, new opportunities, new mechanisms, and things are happening. And one of the things that's most important is the Daniel 12:4, in the time of the end, knowledge shall be increased and man will travel to and fro. Transportation, this whole idea of going to and fro, is absolutely crucial to this. Trains, barges, ships. This, because of transportation becomes easier to transport not just people, but farm goods and immense quantities of materials. Now you can have international trade. It used to be the farming and the farm produce, and if he would sell his crops, what a price he'd get. This is merely a local phenomenon because you could not physically take it, you know, to another country or across an ocean, but with to and fro, all of a sudden this becomes possible. So if we take a look at this transportation, we have trains and barges. And these photos were actually taken around the 1880s. You have steam trains carrying crops to rivers. We have barges, steam barges, carrying them down the river. We have a move from sail to steam in the 1870s. Now, you've probably heard of the Cutty Sark. There's some brand of booze, some liquor or something. I don't know what it is, but it's named after this ship. And this ship was built in 1877, and this is the last clipper ship of any size that was made. I think it was for shipping tea or something. But around that, why were they just not shipping anymore? They're actually doing more shipping than ever, but the ships were steamships. This is in the middle 1800s. This is how it was. It was much more dependable. Take larger cargo, could go with the wind or against the wind. And this is the to and fro. This is now linking the countries economically. In fact, if you look at the United States in the latter part of the 19th century, in the 1880s, 1890s, etc., 80% of U.S. exports was farm goods, was grain, 80% of our exports. So the world was quickly becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. Countries were being linked together economically, not simply through sending money back and forth and treaties, but actually in sending the products. So cotton, wheat, etc. International trade is where things are being sold. This brings on international competition. So Europe, Argentina, India, Australia, Russia, Pakistan, China, etc. All of these are both consumers and producers of agricultural products. And because of this, the transportation, now the markets are linked and the prices are linked. Very, very important. Well, as soon as you start selling on the international market, you're looking at international prices. So whatever price they're getting in Argentina, you're going to get the same thing, essentially. So everything is going to be linked together. Now, if we take a look at the United States versus Europe, we'll find a lot of things are similar, but some things are significantly different. In the United States, it was larger farms. They were family-owned. In Europe, they were smaller farms, and they were rented. In fact, this is one of the reasons why people wanted to come to this new world, to the United States, because they could own land. All you have to do is head west, young man, and you can get your land. Now, maybe you get killed on the way, but you have an opportunity. If you can stay alive, have kids, you know, you need labor on your farm as well. You can have a large farm, essentially. So we have crops. They sell their crops for their livelihood. Now, if we look back to 1873, prices were good, sales were good, life was good. But both of these groups in the U.S. and Europe, they're dependent upon the sale of their crops for their livelihood. In Europe, if they can't make much money selling their crops, they can't pay their rent, and the landowners will kick them off the land. The landowners are not going to say, "Oh, well, I understand. Yeah, it's just hard times. That's okay." No, no, that's not how it works. You just get kicked out and get somebody else. So if we take a look at how things were in 1873, here's what farm trade was. You grow your crops. You'd sell your crops, you'd receive money, and that money was essentially silver. Silver was the major money used in all of these countries. In other words, a certain amount of silver was defined to be a dollar or a yen or whatever the unit of trade was. That amount of silver was defined to have this value as money. This is what established the international price. In fact, these are trade dollars, 1874 trade dollars. Here's one right here. We'll pass this around. So this money could then be, this was money, you could then take it, buy the equipment, because with increasing demand, increasing technology, you had to be more and more efficient. So they buy the equipment, grow the crops, sell the crops, receive the money in silver, buy the equipment, etc. And this, here's how trade was. And everything worked great, and everybody was happy. But then things began to change. In 1874... some changes are taking place. Prices begin to fall. Farm prices begin to fall. Later, they plummet. In fact, in the United States, from 1873 until 1896, there was a price drop in the price of wheat of 53%. Over half of what they got for their crop, gone. In Europe, in England, from 1873 to 1894, it was a 61% drop in the price of wheat. The bottom's just falling out. Well, just think of that. What if you had a business and you're still doing the work and you're still selling the same product, but you're getting less and less for it? In 1878, the price of wheat was $1.20. In 1896, it was 56 cents, less than half. That's a 53% drop in the price. That's dramatic. There's something going on. Something going on. Well, what's causing this? Well, a lot of folks at the time says, well, you know, we got these tractors now and all this farm equipment. We must be just overproducing. That's probably what it is. So a fellow named Robert Lindblom in the Chicago Board of Trade, and Brother Russell mentions this in the Christ of the Reaper chapter, he said, well, let's look at that. Is it really overproduction? So he looks at the year 1883, there was 1,565,000 bushels produced. In 1893, there was only 1,479,000. Production is down by 5%. Production is going down, Well, if supply and demand, if you have less, the prices should go up, right? But what was happening is the price was going down, 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 down. So there's something else going on. What was going on? Well, what we'll find, it was a manipulation of the money supply itself. Not only a manipulation of the money supply, but a manipulation and change in what was considered as money. Now, before we talk about that, we want to talk about some basic economic principles about money and what it can buy. Now, if you have the money supply here, the amount of money in your economy here, and the amount of goods and services in your economy, and they're essentially balanced, what you'll find is as long as they're about nicely balanced, you have price stability. Prices stay the same. You can increase the money supply if you increase the goods and services. As long as they're a nice balance, your dollars will always have essentially the same value. But if there is an imbalance, for instance, if you have price stability, if the money supply gets much, much, much bigger, but the goods and services don't increase, or if they decrease, what'll happen is you'll have inflation. In other words, every product has much, much more money to buy it with. You know, it's almost like a sailor on payday. You know, all the shopkeepers and the bars, they know the sailors just got paid. They got all this money in their pockets. Well, they can raise their prices and say, well, I got so much, so what? And actually, this lesson was learned in history back between, we have inflation. But in Spain in the 1500s, they got gold and silver from the Incas. They brought it over. Their methods were not righteous at all. But they brought over, here's what they brought, 181 tons of gold, over 16,000, almost 17,000 tons of silver. That's just amazing. They brought it to Europe, but notice they didn't bring any more goods and services. It was the same gross national product of Europe. They didn't bring any furniture, any clothes, any food. All they brought was tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of gold and silver. So what happens? Well, all of the goods that Europe was producing, there is now more money to buy them with, so prices go up. This is inflation. Prices rise. Now, this is great for the guys who actually brought over the gold because they get to spend it first. For everybody else, the prices go up. They don't have the money. Eventually, it all sort of evens itself out. But the balance of goods and services to money must be carefully managed. Now, what if the money supply goes down and the goods and services go up? Well, now, all these products, you have more and more products competing for less and less money. So this causes deflation. Prices go down, down, down. And if it continues, it goes to depression. In a depression, what happens? In a classic depression, there's just not enough money to go around. You know, I remember my mom saying, oh yeah, in the Great Depression in the 30s, bread was only a nickel, but nobody had a nickel. So if that's the case, even though prices are very low, the economy, there's no lifeblood in the economy to keep it going. So when we take a look at this, and who is affected by a situation like this? Well, when money is scarce, you have deflation or depression in the economy and prices. Prices fall. What about the bankers, the lenders? They actually have more profits. Because if they lend you $100 and you're going to pay it back in 5 years, well, if your money is getting... if prices are dropping over that 5 years, then that money that you have to earn to pay back the bank is harder to come by. And every dollar you give to the bank is that much more valuable. So the bankers think, oh, deflation, good. Because we can control that money supply, we'll lend it out, and when we get it back, it's going to be more and more valuable. How about if you're a farmer, you're borrowing money? Well, you borrow the money, so you get $100 to spend, but as you have to make that money back, your prices are going down, you have to work harder, it's harder and harder to repay. So every dollar is much more valuable over time. The bankers are making more and you're making less and less. It's very, very, very difficult to repay loans in a depression, in deflation. So, in order to see what was actually happening in Brother Russell's day and beyond, we actually have to go back a little bit in time to the time of the Civil War. Now, in 1862, Abraham Lincoln, actually a very brilliant man, he realized if you're going to have to fight, if you're going to fight a war, you've got to have the currency to do it with. The economy has to be very vibrant because you have to have lots of manufacturing and technology to support this. So he said, well, the government has the authority to issue money. What we're going to do is we're going to issue greenbacks, paper money. Instead of gold and silver, we're going to print this stuff, and this is going to be legal tender. And he printed $450 million of it. They were called greenbacks. Here's a picture of one. Here's a $5 greenback because it was green on the back. That's where the name greenback came from. The financiers and the bankers hated it. They thought, well, this is inflationary. You've got all this, all much, much more money. Prices were actually rising. So when bankers would get paid back with this inflated currency, it wasn't worth as much to them. So with Lincoln's death in 1866, we have the Contraction Act. What they wanted to do is, let's get rid of these greenbacks. Let's get them out of the economic system. Let's deflate the economic system. Deflate the amount of money. And here's what they did. Between 1866, this is the millions of dollars that were in circulation. We had $1,800,000,000 in circulation. But they kept taking the greenbacks out, contracting the money supply. By 1886, there's only $400 million. Now, when you look at that, that's a 78% drop in the money supply. That is an incredible, incredible shrinkage. And the way banking works, this is not just a 78% drop in the effective money supply, it's actually about at least tenfold that. And when they take that much money out of the money supply, there's just not enough money to spend. There's just not enough money to spend. What historians call this period, actually from 1873 to 1896, was the Long Depression. The Long Depression. And here's some of the dynamics that's causing it. You have restitution. Goods and services are actually increasing. You've got factories cranking out goods. You have people being thrown out of work because they don't need them. Because you have labor-saving machineries, factories are mass-producing things. So the actual value of goods and services is going up, up, up. In fact, the gross domestic product was going up 6% every year. That is tremendous. Our economy doesn't do anything close to that nowadays. But the money supply was lagging behind. In fact, prices were falling between 1% and 3% every year as that money supply was contracting. Unemployment was rising between 20 and 30%. 20 and 30%. That's amazing. There just was not enough money in circulation. In fact, things were so bad, this was compared to the Dark Ages. There was so little money in the money supply. The amount of money in the money supply was similar to the Dark Ages. In the Dark Ages, you know, where the landowners, the kings, they owned everything, and the serfs are out working in the field, they say, well, what do you need money for? If you need something, I'll provide it. If you need it to stay alive, I'll provide it. But discretionary spending, are you kidding? That's not what it was for. And that was essentially how it was during this period of time. There's virtually no money for people to spend. Well, what was money anyway? Well, if we look at 1873, what people like to consider as money is a silver dollar or a gold dollar. And those are the relative sizes. This is an 1873 silver dollar. You'll probably never see one. They virtually were all melted down to get the silver. But what they wanted is, if you look at the silver dollar, this had $1 worth of silver in it in 1873. This had $1 worth of gold in it in 1873. So there was a standard, this ratio of gold and silver. But what this means is, if you're going to get more money that people respect and feel that has intrinsic value, you have to actually get more gold and silver into mint and make coins. So who's really controlling the money supply? Well, where does the money supply come from? Here he is. This is your Alan Greenspan back in the 1870s. Okay, this guy, you had to actually find it, dig it out, smelt it. So he would take his bag of gold dust, and he could actually spend the gold dust itself. In fact, if you look at the 49ers and the gold rush, the saloon keepers, what they would do, they knew that the guys didn't have money, but they had gold dust. So what they would do is they would hire some big burly monster to be the bartender, because a drink only costs one pinch of gold. So they get the guy with, you know, steam shovel size fingers, and he'd go in and go, you know, and pour the guy his drink. They weren't stupid. So there was, but they realized the inequity of this, and there was a real push to in the time of the gold rush and after, to actually mint the coins, to actually have some standardization. This is a picture of the San Francisco Mint in 1879. We also have the Carson City Mint. And the way this worked at that time is you could actually bring in your gold, they would assay it, and if it was pure enough, they would smelt it and actually produce the gold and give you your gold. Here are your coins. So you take in the... So any person could independently increase the money supply. They just bring, again, they figured, well, it took a lot of labor and work to do this, so you're not getting money for nothing. You're exchanging your labor and et cetera to put this into the money supply. Well, this is unheard of today. Well, finally, in 1897, we have the Long Depression ends. Now, note that this is when the fourth volume was written. And when I was first looking at that, I thought, gee, did Brother Russell miss something here in his discussion of the cries of the reapers? Well, we have the Klondike Gold, and why did it end? Now, keep in mind that this Long Depression, as far as the entire economy was concerned, everybody was hurting because there wasn't enough money in the money supply. Goods and services rising, but the money supply was actually being shrunken. The financiers, the folks controlling it, were shrinking the money supply. Well, why did this end? Well, in 1897, you've got the Klondike Gold Strike, and this brings tremendous amounts of gold to be minted, to be brought into the money supply. Also, there's the South African Gold Strike, South African gold. So now the world simply has more gold. And then another restitution blessing, cyanidization. What this is, it's a cyanide process. Well, actually, we'll dissolve the gold in the ore, and they can actually get about 10 times more gold out of low-grade ore than they ever could before. Because of this, now all of a sudden, you've got lots of gold to mint into coins. You also have the Klondike, Comstock load of silver was discovered. So the money supply is up, prices begin to stabilize. Sounds pretty good. Well, gee, maybe Brother Russell missed the boat here, because this happened right after the fourth volume came out. Did he miss the boat? No, he didn't. The rest of the economy was doing good, but not farmers. Not farmers. They were hardest hit. The prices were still down in both the U.S. and Christendom. And what we want to see is, why did this happen? The farmers are still struggling. Their prices are not going up with the rest of prices. The prices are not going up. Well, in order to understand this, we have to go back to 1792. This is when the gold and silver standard was established in this country. Alexander Hamilton, a brilliant man, he's the one who recommended this, a bimetallic standard where you have 16 ounces of silver will equal 1 ounce of gold. In other words, gold is 16 times more valuable than silver. This was by law. And in 1873, a $1 coin would have either $1 worth of gold in it or $1 worth of silver. So you can see the... Now, none of them were pure gold or silver because that was too soft, but they would alloy it. But that's why the silver dollar is about 16 times the size of a gold dollar. That's what you find. Okay. Well, then changes come to this. What change happens? Well, in 1874, good year, the effects of the Coinage Act of 1873 starts taking place. And what this did is it said, we're not going to make silver dollars anymore. In other words, it said, here are all the coins that the mint is going to make, and the silver dollar was taken out. In fact, it was demonetized. What that means is a silver dollar, you know, like this silver dollar right here, this is not good for all debts, public and private. It turns out you could spend up to $5. People could accept up to $5 in by law in silver, and the rest had to be in gold. Okay, so this was no longer legal tender. That's what this act did. And what it did is it made silver was no longer money. Silver was actually a commodity. The value of silver would float, just like the price of, you know, beans or corn or whatever. That goes up and down with supply and demand. Because it's no longer can be coined into money, the demand for silver itself goes down, and the price of silver drops precipitously. In other words, just like rain, falls. Well, with this Coinage Act of 1873, it also meant if you were a silver miner, you couldn't take your silver in and have it made into coins anymore. Couldn't do that. Only the government could now coin silver. There's no more free silver. And we'll see that the reason for that is this. Because when the financiers demonetize silver, the price of silver goes down. This is the value of 1 ounce of silver. Now keep in mind, a silver dollar does not have a whole ounce in it. Okay, it's like 0.8 of an ounce or somewhere around there. It's maybe 0.75 ounces. So it's a little less than the ounce. But the price of an ounce of silver in 1873 was $1.30. By 1896, it went down to 68 cents. That's less than half. So the silver prices are plummeting. And notice between... and this is the period of the Long Depression. Long Depression. Well, what happens with the Long Depression is you have all this gold that's going back into the money supply. There's some silver, but this gold is really what is getting the countries out of the Long Depression. This is a 48% drop in the price of silver between 1873 and 1896. As we continue on, we'll see this price stays very low all the way through 1914 and into 1915. In wars, this is when metals, and during wartime, this is when metals are really seen as a source of stability and people want to buy them and their prices go up. Okay. Now, why is this so important? Well, the farmers have to sell their crop on the international market. The international market is actually uses silver. Because in other countries, Argentina, Canada, China, it's still monetized. In other words, a certain amount of silver is defined to be a dollar. So the international price was in silver. But when the U.S. farmers receive that silver, what happens? It's not money. They have to take that silver, convert it to gold, so they can then buy the things that they need. We'll see more of that in a little bit. Well, why demonetize silver? Well, if you're a manufacturer, you can buy the raw materials, which are mainly agricultural products, and you can sell the manufactured goods. And because manufacturing requires lots of capital, that's the whole idea of capitalism. You buy something that's very expensive that others don't have, and that will create wealth for you. So, and if you have a manufacturing monopoly, you can buy your raw materials at a low price and you can sell them at a high price. And if you have a true monopoly, you just name your price. And if it's something people absolutely need, they will pay for it. Kind of, it makes you think of gasoline. Okay, nowadays. Well, England, in the early 1800s, they had a textile monopoly. Essentially, they would buy cotton and other farm products. They would sell cloth and clothing, and they could essentially name their price. In fact, they had such a monopoly over this, and this technology of textile was so well guarded by them, it was actually illegal for anyone to transport any engineering drawings or anything out of England. In fact, the way the textile industry started in this country is there's a fellow he was a British guy. He was an Englishman, okay? And he worked as an engineer in the textile industry for about 15 years. And when he left and came to this country, he had memorized the drawings. He memorized everything, so he regenerated it and was able to start up the textile industry here. But they were really keeping a monopoly on this. And the whole idea is you buy your raw materials at a silver price. They would like the silver. They could buy it in silver, but they would like to be able, that silver to be less and less and less expensive for them. But then they could require, sell the cloth and the clothing for gold because they have the monopoly. They can set their price. Well, if we take a look at the relative share of manufacturing of the United Kingdom versus the rest of the world, here's the Habsburg Empire, France, Germany, Italy, Russia, and here's little old United States in 1750. You know, we're hardly enough to even register on the scale. And this is in percentages. So what you're going to find is these all the height of all these things would added together would always be the same. Okay, so in percentages. By 1800, the United Kingdom is realizing if you're going to fight wars, you don't need to do it with bullets and ships and guns and cannons. You can do it economically. If you really want to take the wealth from your, if you really want to improve your standard of living, do it economically. Those are the real battles to be fought. So they become, they're enhancing their manufacturing capability. Here's the United States growing a little bit, not much, you know, hardly enough to speak of. By 1830, the United Kingdom, they've really got the picture. Manufacturing's where it's at. And manufacturing was also necessary, keep in mind, so you can fight wars properly, efficiently. You know, because the war is one of the greatest drivers of technology. But here comes the United States. Notice the United States is now outpacing Italy. It's starting to become peers with the rest of countries in Europe. And as we continue on to 1860, the United States is now one of the major players. It's about the same as France. It's exceeded everybody else but France. Look at the United Kingdom. They're just they're monsters. And as we continue on to 1873, the rest of Europe, they're being left in the dust. United Kingdom, they're still in the catbird seat. But who's right behind? Who's becoming the threat? Who has a, what country has a population that's growing and growing and has virtually unlimited land and resources? So, what to do? What to do? Well, they're facing manufacturing competition, competitors who can sell for either silver or gold. Ones who can actually undercut England. So what to do? What could England do? Now let's see. They could just lower their prices, right? But that's not the English way. We're not going to do that. The English, they their politics and economy, they call it the great game, this game that they play. They're very secretive. They do things to influence the rest of the world without the world knowing it. So what do they do? They said, oh, I'll tell you what. How about if we make our competition raise their prices without even knowing it? So they say, let's make our competitors demonetize silver too. That way there will be less money in the world. The price of gold will go up. The price of silver will go down. English can still buy agricultural goods on the international market in silver, which is cheap, but sell their goods in gold. And if we get others, the big players, to demonetize silver, they'll do the same thing, and they won't even know what's going on. So this will keep gold prices high, make silver cheaper, so they can buy their raw materials. So this is what took place. In fact, if we look at the years, in the 1870s, here's when it happened. 1871, they influenced Germany, then Belgium, Italy, and Switzerland by 1873. Now, all they had to do here is they could talk to the relatives. You know, they're all related. They think, well, the Brits, you know, they're pretty smart. They did it. I guess we should do it. For this country in the United States, it was demonetized in 1873, Scandinavia, etc. But finally, you look, all of Europe has been demonetized by 1880. Well, how did this affect the farmers in both the U.S. and in Christendom? Well, they still have to grow their crops and sell their crops, but now they receive silver, which is no longer money. It's a commodity. But if they're going to actually buy the manufactured goods they need from England or the United States, really, they have to sell that silver and buy gold for it. So the silver price, they're, is essentially getting 50 cents on the dollar. in 1873, the silver in a silver dollar, this is worth the gold in a gold dollar. But by 1890s, it's only worth about 50 cents. So they're getting 50 cents on the dollar. They take their 50 cents worth of silver, they get the 50 cents worth of gold out of it, then they buy the manufactured goods. So every time they sell their crops, they're losing 50 cents. Now the other countries, the other major agricultural players, when they get silver, they can go down and spend it in their country because it is money. It is monetized. There is a parity between the silver and the gold. So this is why the farmers are so terribly hit. Why do they need this? They had to keep up with technology to stay competitive. We have in the 1700s, we have a wooden plow. Well, wooden plows going through that hard ground and rocks, it's going to break. In the 1820s, they had a cast iron plow, much better but very brittle, and it breaks. So you finally have the steel plow that's coming out in the 1850s and beyond. In the 1870s, we have horsepower. Here's a threshing machine using horses. By the 1880s, we have tractors coming out. Tractors that are not only threshing but used as the power source in the fields. Try making a tractor like this one winter in your barn. Think the farmers can do that themselves? No. They can make the other farm implements pretty well. But there's some manufactured goods that they absolutely have to have if they're going to be competitive. So, this demonetization of silver, it hits the Americans very hard. But for the Europeans, it was absolutely devastating. For the Europeans, they're the ones who actually had to pay rent, and their prices plummeted even more than in the United States. This shook Christendom to the very bone. Well, how about the politicians? Did they understand what was going on? We'll go through these quickly. Senator Thurman, this is in the United States. When the bill pending in the Senate, we thought it was simply a bill to reform the mint, regulate coinage, fix up some things. Not a single man in the Senate, unless a member of the committee itself from which the bill came, had the slightest idea what was going on. Senator Beck, if the bill demonetizing silver never was understood either by the House or Congress, I say that with full knowledge. Not even the newspaper reporters could figure this out. And they're the peskiest ones who always dig down and they're trying to find dirt. They didn't understand. Colonel Ingersoll, he says, I asked for the re-demonetization of silver. Silver was demonetized by fraud. It was an imposition upon every solvent man, a fraud upon every honest debtor in the United States. It assassinates labor. It was done in the interest of avarice and greed and should be undone by honest men. In fact, if you look up the crime of 1873... you'll find hundreds of references. This was the crime of 1873, the demonetization of silver. Senator Vance, he said, the power of money and its allies throughout the world have entered into this conspiracy to perpetrate the greatest crime of this or any other age, to overthrow one half of the world's money supply, thereby double their own wealth by enhancing the value of the other half, which was gold, which they had control of in their hands. Well, how about the kings? After all, they're ruling by divine right. You know, God save the king. They're brilliant. They have God-given knowledge, right? Well, let's see what the kings had to say. Prince Bismarck, I'm too old to go to school over this currency issue. I recognize that although I acted in 1873 on what I regarded was the best advice, he could have said by my relatives, my action was too precipitate. In other words, it was too fast in view of the results. The one class that we cannot afford to estrange is the farming class. They're realizing this is hitting the farmers harder than anybody. Well, was there help? I mean, once governments found out about this. Well, if we look in this country, we have the Bland-Allison Act. What this was, it was an act to sort of remonetize silver. Now, it didn't really remonetize it. It allowed the government to make silver dollars. This is an 1878 silver dollar. The reason why this is in my hand is because of the Bland-Allison Act. What they did, as I said, okay, people are used to silver dollars. We're going to start minting them again, but they're not going to be legal tender. You can spend them, but really, actually, for debts over the $5, you're supposed to use gold. I don't think a lot of people paid attention to that. It was not worth a dollar as far as the silver value. It was only worth about 50 cents. So only the government could mint this. In other words, a private citizen couldn't take his silver and say, oh, I got 100 pounds of silver, let's mint it. You know, how much that 100 pounds of silver cost you? Oh, I don't know, let's say $1,000. Well, you mint it, now you have $2,000 to spend. Well, the government's not going to let you do that, so only a government can do it. And they wanted to do it to put more money into the money supply. If you look at the silver in the U.S. silver dollar in 1873, it had exactly $1 of silver in it. That same silver dollar, same weight, same amount of silver, the silver is now worth only 52 cents in 1896. So you're not going to let private citizens coin, you know, bring in their own silver and coin that. So the result of the Bland-Allison Act, it increased the money supply, it helped deflation, but it was no help to the farmers because silver was not remonetized again. They were still receiving foreign silver for their international trade. It was still silver was still a commodity in U.S. and Europe, and they still were getting about 50 cents on the dollar. Then they had the Sherman Silver Purchase Act in 1890. This is more of the same, where they were going to buy and mint more silver. The U.S. Treasury would do that. They would issue notes in order to buy this, and they were redeemable in either gold or silver. And here's one of the notes. Here's one of the notes. Now notice it was redeemable in coin. Now if you're a smart guy, are you going to take your gold coins or silver coins? Well, of course you're going to take gold coins. And so the speculators, they bought up these notes, they redeemed them for gold, and the U.S. gold supply was threatened and the United States was going to go bankrupt. And later they realized this was a scandal and they almost threw the Secretary of Treasury in prison. So there was just no way out of this. In 1896, William Jennings Bryan, he gave the famous Cross of Gold speech, who says, "You'll not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns, you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." But it was too late. The toothpaste was out of the tube and you can't get it back in. Because even though he's crying over the farmers, the businessmen really liked the fact that they were getting gold and they can buy agricultural products for silver. The businessmen really, really liked this, no matter what altruistic things that they were saying. So, who did this? It was the financiers in England. The Coinage Act of 1873, it was bribery. Actually, there's evidence that they brought $500,000 over. They bribed the right parties, went back to England, said, there you go. In Europe, it's through their influence in the 1880s, but this really served to show the ignorance of the kings and the politicians. The kings of Christendom didn't understand what they were doing. They were pawns in the hands of the financiers, and really pawns in the hands of God and his plan, which we'll see in a minute. This spread distrust of kings and the divine right. They realized the kings are not helping us. They can't control our society. They're from a bygone age, and they are incompetent. Well, by 1914, the damage was done. The farmers were losing their confidence in their leaders. This was another nail in the coffin of the old idea of the divine right of kings, the church-state system, the old order itself. As the Gentile times were ending in 1914, is there any good news? Well, when I think of Gentiles, I think, okay, you got Jews and Gentiles. Well, if the Gentile times are ending, it means Jewish times must be beginning, right? Well, did anything good come of this? Well, the wealth to the English financiers, the Rothschilds, Montefiore, Hirsch, etc., in reprint 41 way back there, and I think it's in 1879 or maybe 1880, Baron Rothschild lends Turkey $40 million in gold, receives the deed to Palestine as security for that loan. Rothschild, Hirsch, Montefiore then spend millions of dollars for schools, industry, communities, lands, infrastructure, etc. Where'd they get all this gold? They got it because of the demonetization of silver. They knew what they were doing. Now, they didn't give all their gold to fund Zionism, that's for sure. But some of it they did. Well, was there any justice in this? If you look at the Jews in Christendom, which is one of our original questions, is there any justice in this? If you look at the Jews in Christendom, they were persecuted, killed, robbed, and expelled again and again and again. Whenever a king or a little petty ruler, he squandered his money in some way, was irresponsible, how did he make up for it? Well, he blamed the Jews, expelled the Jews, take their lands, whatever lands they may have, take their funding, take their banks, their bank accounts, etc. And this happened again and again and again and again. And if we look at the history of Jewish expulsions, now look up here because you want, I couldn't put a list all on your, but here's a list from 554 to 360 in all the various countries where it took place. But again and again and again and again and again and again. It's just, I mean, killing. And what they would do is, once the Jews are gone, they've taken all their wealth, they'd wait 8 or 10 years, maybe 15 years, and they'd bring it, let them come back in. They don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And when they'd come back in, they'd charge them to get back into the country. And they'd wait until they were rich again through their work, their labor, and their ingenuity. And then they'd just take it all away. So when we look at the flow of gold and how God overruled this. This is a map of the world in 1914. Because of the demonetization of silver, because England has the greatest manufacturing capability, England and the nations of Europe, in order to buy the manufactured goods, here's the way the gold flowed. It flowed from all around the world into the British Isles. And Rothschild and others, what do they do with it? They use it to fund Zionism. God says, all the gold and silver is mine. And here's how God, here's the dynamic that God is using to make sure his people get what they need to go back to their promised land. Now, is there any precedent for this in God's plan? Well, if we go back to the days of Joseph. Joseph comes to Egypt. Joseph through God, I should say. God had the information. Joseph was the messenger. Let's put it that way. He interprets Pharaoh's dream, the 7 years of plenty. They store the grain. They sell it in the 7 years of famine. In the known world at that time, in order to just stay alive, the gold flows into Egypt. Pretty soon they spend their money, then they give their land, and then they give themselves as slaves. So here's where all the gold ends up. But when it's time to send his people to their promised land, what does God do? He says, when ye go, ye shall not go empty. Ye shall spoil the Egyptians. So they borrowed this gold, which really the Egyptians were made wealthy because of God himself interpreting Pharaoh's dream, which God had given Pharaoh, simply for this dynamic to work. So the gold now flows to Palestine. God's not stupid. He knows that for his people to do these things, they're going to need the financing. They're going to need the economic power, both at this time, leaving Egypt, and at the time of Zionism. In the Jeremiah 16, 14, and 15, it shall no longer be said, the Lord God liveth, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but the Lord God liveth, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north, from all the lands where they had driven, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto them, and I'm going to finance their trip. He's going to finance their trip. Well, after the Great War, with the failed monetary policies of the world, it resulted in the Great Depression, in German hyperinflation. In fact, in the Great Depression, when they saw banks failing, what did they do? They contracted the money supply again. They said, well, the banks don't have enough reserves in their vault, so they made the reserve rate higher, which contracted the money supply tremendously. Now nobody had any money to pay their loans. So everything crashed. German hyperinflation, which brings on World War II. But after that, we have the Marshall Plan. What was World War II? It was an attempt to establish a church-state system. The Thousand-Year Reich, that's what it was. That was the whole idea. God says, no, we already got rid of that once, and we're going to not let it happen again. What about after this? We have the Marshall Plan, which actually is the way, don't make your enemies pay debts, actually help them, bless them. Kingdom ideas. Better monetary policy. The gold standard was gone in 1972. That was taken away. Well, what backs our money today? Well, it's not gold. It's candy bars, clothes, hotel rooms. And you might say, what backs this up? This does not say redeemable in gold. It's just legal tender. But what they do is they balance the GNP or the GDP, the gross national product, gross domestic product. They balance that with the money supply. So the money supply is regulated. And here's what backs your money. Cars, candy bars. I saw three for a dollar one place. So it's a chocolate-based economy. You know, that's okay, depending on, you know, how you're feeling that day. So the cries of the reapers, James 5, 1 through 9. Behold, the hire of the laborers who you have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. The cries of them which have reaped are entered in the ears of the Lord. You have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. But behold, now the judge standeth before the door. The cries of the reapers was absolutely unstoppable. The dynamics that were happening were absolutely unstoppable. God used this to shake Christendom to the bone, so it would topple and fall. In Revelation 18:5, for her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. And she was going to go down, and she did. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Harry.